It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's how Buddhism and karma shapes the most intricate cooking in Southeast Asia. Our guest calls it the cuisine that takes no prisoners. He is David Thompson. His book is Thai Food, perhaps the most complete study we've seen so far. Our big news, the Frito pie has been saved from extinction, and the Sterns are celebrating. David Rosengarten toasts Robert Mondavi's 90th birthday by tasting every wine he makes. Travel and Leisure magazine's Anya von Bremsen goes home again to Russia and a booming new food scene. Then Calvin Trillin turns a ride to the airport into an adventure in raw fish. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wind me. Dine me, don't try to fool me, be you me, either amuse me or lose me, I'm getting hungry, peel me a grape. Pop me a cork, French me a fry, crack me a nut, bring a bowl full of bonbons, chill me some wine, keep standing by, just entertain me, champagne me, show me you love me, kid love me, best way to cheer me. Cashmere me, I'm getting hungry. Peel me. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap, when I say do it, jump to it. Sent out for scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals. Just hang around, pick up the tab, and never outthink me. Just mink me, polar bear rug me, don't bug me, new thunder burn me, you heard me, I'm getting hungry, peel me a grape. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap, when I say do it. Scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals, just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me, just mink me, polar bear rug me, don't bug me.
me new with thunder burden me. You heard me, I am getting hungry.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Today, it's the cuisine that takes no prisoners. Our guest is David Thompson. His book is the award-winning Thai Food, perhaps the most complex cooking in all of Southeast Asia. It's Robert Mondavi's 90th birthday. Food and wine expert David Rosengarten celebrates by taste testing every wine this pioneer has made. Now, this is what I call a party. Travel and Leisure magazine's Anya von Bremsen goes home to Russia and a food scene that is booming with nostalgia. Then we ramble with Calvin Trillin on what starts as a ride to the airport and ends up being a side trip into ceviche land. And as always, in the second half of the show, we are going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with the ever hungry, ever curious, Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, we were really sad and worried a few years ago when we heard that the Woolworths on the plaza in Santa Fe closed because that was the great, great place to eat Frito's pie. In fact, it was the place Frito's pie was invented many years ago by Teresa Hernandez. Of course, you know, Frito's pie is an actual bag of Fritos that is opened up, into which is ladled some nice New Mexican, moderately hot chili, a little bit of cheese on top of that. The cheese starts to melt, maybe some raw onions on top of that. You plant a plastic fork in it, and you can eat while you walk around the plaza. It's kind of a perfect street food. However, the Woolworths closed a few years ago, and we thought, well, that's the end of that. And in fact, we went back a little while ago, and we found the Five and Dime General Store right where the Woolworths used to be, serving the same Fritos pie made by the same chef, Teresa Hernandez.
And it even looks the same. They have the same sort of 1960s postcards in a revolving rack and, you know, gewgaws and doodads and all sorts of kind of, you know, silly tourist stuff. But Michael, why are you saying Fritos pie? Isn't it Frito pie?
No, there is no such thing as a Frito. That's like a grit. Fritos is always plural.
I don't agree.
There is no such thing as a Frito. It is a Fritos.
Well, now, look, children, don't
but
fight.
It's like
don't fight.
Parts?
But
yes.
I think you should
He's
tell.
Wrong.
I think you two should tell the world about New Mexico chili because it's different than other chilies, right?
Oh, my gosh. This is a whole. Yes.
Where to begin?
First of all, it's spelled differently. In New Mexico, they spell chili with an E rather than an I at the end because they do that to honor the fact that chili is a vegetable. In fact, it is the state vegetable. So when they make a dish called chili, it is always one that features the chili pepper much more than the meat. In fact, oftentimes when you order chili in New Mexico, there's no meat in it at all. It's merely pureed chilies.
Don't you just love the idea of the state vegetable? Do you know what your state vegetable is? I think I'm our state vegetable.
But the other thing, though, is that if it does have meat in it, it never has beans. And
that is correct. The beans are on the side. And in fact, there's a huge kind of bean chili dichotomy in the state because I did kind of misspeak just now. New Mexico has two state vegetables. They couldn't decide when the state legislature dealt with this issue. So, in fact, the pinto bean and the chili pepper are the co-state vegetables of New Mexico. And if you do order chili, and if it does have meat, you might also get a bowl of beans on the side, which maybe you would want to spoon into your chili, but maybe not.
Now, tell me what else they do at this Five and Dime. And did they buy all of the inventory from the old Woolworths?
It sure looks like it, because some of the things on these shelves are things that haven't been made in decades, it seems to me anyway. Some of the postcards, in fact, are really old sort of linen-type postcards. As far as eating goes, frankly, I don't know if there's anything else on the menu besides Frito's pie.
Frito pie.
Okay.
Whatever it is, I think that's the, at least that's the only thing I have ever eaten there and the only thing I ever will eat there.
Thank you both.
Michael is so weird.
I am correct. I am not weird.
We're leaving now. Goodbye.
Bye, Lynn. Bye. We'll discuss this later.
In private.
It is Frito's pie. It's like
a
grit.
Frito pie.
You say either and I say either. You say neither and I say neither. Either, either, neither, neither. Let's call the whole thing off.
You Jane and Michael Stern's newest book in their road food series is Louie's Backyard Cookbook. Now, every week they come by with a report and a tussle, but you can get their food finds anytime. You know the drill. It's splendidtable.org. Now, talking about Frito pie reminded me of my first lesson in snobbery and snack food. It was in New York. It was the 1970s, and we non-Asians had just discovered that Chinese food went beyond chow mein. Now, at the same time, food snobbery was reaching new heights. If authentic was not branded on everything you ate, you might as well pack up and move to L.A. Well, the hot Chinese cooking teacher at the time was Virginia Lee. She had waiting lists for years, food critics were kissing the hem of her apron, and she flat out stated that everything she made was absolutely authentic. Well, I was nuts for her lion's head. Now, these are crisp fried meatballs in this tumble of cabbage, but hers were crisper, sweeter, crunchier than anything I had ever tasted. Well, she said it was because they were truly Chinese. I discovered it was because they were truly Kellogg. Virginia Lee coated her lion's head in cornflakes. Now, obviously, she knew a better mousetrap when she saw one. But if only she hadn't made all that fuss over authentic. So if Fritos are great with your chili, why not serve them in the bag? David Rosengarten is creator of the Rosengarten Report, his food and wine newsletter. In it, David tastes, David evaluates, and David tells all. Well, David's latest expedition has been into Mondavi wines. David, welcome back to the Splendid Table.
Hello, Lynn. Great to talk to you.
So what brought you to Mondavi wines?
Well, you know, of course, Robert Mondavi Wines, it's a brand that everybody knows. It's one of the most important brands in California, and he's a real trailblazer. I paid a visit to the winery a couple years ago just to look around and see what's going on, and I ran into incredible wines. I mean, I've always liked Mondavi wines, but at a lunch I had there, I was so struck by what they're turning out right now, and the person with whom I had lunch, who was one of the public relations people at the winery, said, well, you know, Tim, and Tim is Robert Mondavi's son, Tim Mondavi, Tim is now making the kinds of wines that he wants to drink. And when they started to serve the lunch, I could see what Tim wants to drink. He wants to drink wines that really go well with food. They have lightness and grace and harmony and balance. And they're not like many of the kind of heavy, oafish, over-oaked wines that we think of coming from Napa Valley.
So is this a real change in style for the Mondavi people?
You know, I think that they've been heading in that direction for years. And Tim has been making wine for quite a few years at the Mondavi Winery. But I think his heart now is really in this food-loving, food-friendly, much lighter, more graceful style. I can't really track exactly when it happened, but I can tell you that a whole bunch of recent releases from, let's say, 99 through 2001 mm-hmm. are definitely in this style.
So you tasted a lot of these guys, right?
Oh, yes. And then after tasting at the winery, I made a little arrangement to taste the wines back at my home in New York. And I tasted through 36 current Mondavi releases over 3 days with a lot of food around to make sure they were going with food. And I was just, Lynn, I was blown away. These are the best wines, I think, that Mondavi has ever been making.
Well, were there surprises? Were there things that really amazed you?
Well, for one thing, I'm not a great lover of Napa Valley Chardonnay, I have to say. I mean, it's big, impressive wine, but I like wine for food, and it doesn't really go that easily with many things. So, yes, that was a huge surprise for me to taste a couple of Mondavi Chardonnays that were so graceful. They were like white Burgundy. They were absolutely fabulous. The one that I like the best is called the Huichica Hills Chardonnay from a vineyard in Carneros, but it's a little hard to get that one. Their 2000 Chardonnay Reserve Napa Valley, which costs $38 a bottle and is widely available, absolutely terrific wine for food and a surprise for me. Another big surprise in white wine is, you know, I think of Sauvignon Blanc from California as never having the crispness and the grace that Sauvignon Blanc does from the Loire Valley or New Zealand or South Africa. These guys at Mondavi, they have a little block of Sauvignon Blanc grapes in the Stag's Leap district. And if you can find this stuff, I tasted the 2000 Sauvignon Blanc Stag's Leap, which cost $23 a bottle. It is the zingiest, zippiest, most vivid, most alive Sauvignon Blanc from California that I've ever tasted. And I guarantee it'll go with all white wine foods.
Were there any wines that really disappointed you?
Yeah, I would say that I wasn't so happy about the Zinfandel that I tasted, for example. They are making an experiment with a grape from Argentina that's very hot in the wine world today called Malbec, makes red wine. It was okay, but really just a few very, very minor disappointments. For the most part, I mean, the Cabernets alone, I tasted about 10 or 12 Cabernets, and these are monumental wines, Lynn. They're expensive, but the 2000 Cabernet Sauvignon Reserve from Napa Valley, I think can stand with, you know, the great, great Cabernets of the world. I'm talking First Growth Bordeaux. I'm talking Chateau Margaux. I mean, this is absolutely mind-boggling stuff. Did I tell you the price? $125 a bottle.
Oh, well, you taste, we envy. That's what it comes down to. But now, Robert Mondavi's celebrating his 90th birthday, right?
Another good reason to pop a few Mondavi corks.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. He's celebrating it in June. And he was born in Minnesota in 1913. And this guy who has totally transformed the California wine industry has made it to 90, which I think is probably good news for all of us who do firmly believe that wine is good for your health.
It's interesting, though, because he really was a pioneer. I mean, those Cabernet Sauvignons that you talked about, weren't they some of the first wines that he made that got a lot of attention in terms of people looking at California wine with a positive view?
Yes, Mondavi Cabernet, also Mondavi Chardonnay. I think it's the case that when Mondavi started to make wine in Napa Valley, and you know, this particular winery, Robert Mondavi, it doesn't go back that far. I think he started it in the late 60s, perhaps. But he made wine at other places. And California wine used to be, you know, like a distant second cousin to the great wines of Europe, you know. Mm-hmm. But Mondavi came along and said, hey, what we do here could be just as good as what they do there. And he has proven it to the world. I mean, everybody who loves wine everywhere has to pay a debt of gratitude to Robert Mondavi.
Well, happy birthday to Robert Mondavi. Hey, David, thanks.
My pleasure.
David Rosengarten is creator of the Rosengarten Report newsletter. Now, you can find David's picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, the website is also the place where you can sign up for our free weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. And when you subscribe, every week we send you a new recipe for a quick weeknight supper, technique tips, shopping information. It's all free. You just have to sign up, splendidtable.org. Coming up, true Thai food, Calvin Trillin digresses, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. SuperTarget believes in putting the fun back into food. It's a grocery store right inside Target. To find a store near you, you can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget. There is a new book on Thai food. Food professionals are calling it the first complete study. It's almost encyclopedic in scope. The book is called Thai Food. Its author is David Thompson. Not a Thai, but an Australian chef. David has Thai restaurants in Australia and London and consults on Thai culinary heritage for a prestigious college in Bangkok. Now that's all today. But 15 years ago, David had never even been to Thailand. David Thompson, welcome.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
So, David, what got you to Thailand?
An accident, a mistake, really. My life is littered with accidents, as I suspect most people's lives are. I was meant to go to Tahiti for a holiday, and the people with whom I was to stay weren't there. I still had some time up my sleeve, and we had Thai kitchen hands working in the restaurant I was cooking in at the time, and they said go to Thailand. And so, reluctantly, I went there, and I was just seduced by the people, and ultimately it's cooking. And I decided I wanted to move there. I was just so besotted by the place.
What was that first impact? Because you had no idea what this was going to be about.
None whatsoever. None whatsoever. I was an ignorant abroad. There was the happy ease with which the Thais lived their life. That was the first seductive thing. They might be not rich. They might live in poverty, what we would find distressing poverty, some Thais, that is. And yet they had a grace and a happiness that belied their circumstance. And this, to me, was fascinating. I also liked the fact that their lives, Thailand is quite chaotic. And so it was an exciting place, an exciting and yet gracious place. And I think that's the thing that attracted me first of all. In Thailand, one of the things that strikes almost every visitor is it's so food-orientated. Everywhere where you go, wherever there's Thais, there's food. They eat almost incessantly. And if they're not eating food, they're talking about it. And if they're not talking about their food, they're preparing it. That's not to say that they're hedonistic or superficial. It's just one aspect of a complex culture in which they live.
Was there a problem? I mean, you were a foreigner and you stand beside that person at the wok. Was there a problem actually getting inside that environment?
I was a curiosity that somebody was actually interested in cooking or even preparing Thai food, because the Thais are quite a proud people, and they think that Westerners, and often they're right in this, they think that Westerners don't have the patience or the ability to appreciate their food. And one of the problems I find about Thai food, especially Thai food cooked outside of Thailand, is this. Because the Thais are so unfailingly polite, they accommodate their cooking. They compromise, and they'll offer food that they expect Westerners will like. And so very often you'll find in restaurants overseas, and indeed in tourist areas in Thailand, food that does not truly represent what Thais themselves would eat.
Hmm.
And it's a perpetuation of food that truly isn't Thai. You know, things like spring rolls, for example, or egg rolls, I think you'd call them in the States, which litter all Thai restaurants, and whilst in themselves are quite delicious, they ain't necessarily what Thais themselves would eat at home. And that's a bit of a shame, because the Thai food that the Thais love eating is a remarkable cuisine. It's extreme, it's full on. It takes no prisoners when it comes to its cooking tastes.
You talk about in the book the complexity of some Thai food, and you know, one of the images I always have is these curry bases that are pounded, that are blends of so many ingredients. But you talk about your theory of why that aspect of Thai food has evolved to be so complex. Can you explain something about that?
Well, historically, the Thai started off with a very simple type of food, and it's been developed as their culture has become more sophisticated and more complex. One of the things that is remarkable about Thailand, and indeed all Buddhist countries, I hasten to add, is the importance of monks and the support that the laity must give to their monks every morning, twice a morning, just after dawn and just before midday. Thai monks leave their monasteries and go about the village or the precinct of their monastery to collect alms. They're not meant to show any thanks, because in fact what happens is that by them accepting the alms, they're improving the karmic lot of the offerer. They offer it in order to tambun, it's called in Thai, to make merit. And this merit, the amount of merit that's made, which improves your karma, is determined by the effort and the circumstance in which it's given. So if you're very poor and you make an effort of going without a meal, then the karma that you'll accrue will be greater than a rich person who doesn't strive that much. And so therefore I propose that one of the reasons why Thai food increased and became more complex and more sophisticated, flourished in fact, was because these women were trying to improve their karmic lot.
Would these women have written down or recorded in some way what they were doing?
The traditional recipes weren't, and because simply Thai food, the traditional way of cooking or learning about Thai food and teaching it, was just on site, as it were, where you cooked and you talked about it and you remembered. And mm-hmm. It was done so often, it was learnt by rote. Only probably, I mean, I think there were notes that were kept, but they were probably of little use to the cook, who was often illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
It was only about in the 1880s, 1890s, that Thai started to write down their recipes, and even then they were the loose descriptions, not dissimilar to medieval or even 18th century recipes, which were acted as a reminder, mm-hmm. as opposed to an instruction.
Mm-hmm. David, how long did it take you to write this book?
Oh, God. if I told the truth, nowhere near as long as it took me to spend time on it, simply because I spent most of my time staring out the window, firstly. And secondly, I was running restaurants at the time. And so one of the things I used to say to the publisher was that I was too busy working in order to write.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd tell the kitchen I was too busy writing in order to work. And I used to spend some lovely afternoons just staring out the window doing absolutely nothing. But the amount of work in there is probably 3 or 4 years, 5 years perhaps.
Uh-huh. And 15 years ago is when you first went to Thailand. David.
Indeed.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure, Lynn.
David Thompson is author of the award-winning book, Thai Food. He left us with his recipe for Thai grilled chicken. It's spicy, it's easy, great for picnics. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Calvin Trillin is a legend in the food world. He's not a food professional. He's a reporter and essayist by trade. But he's a civilized man. His Tummy Trilogy, about eating his way through life, is now a classic. In his new book, Feeding a Yen, Trillin spins his usual magic. He turns experiences that we never think about into adventures down the side roads of life. For instance, take a ride to the airport.
On a steamy afternoon during a particularly hot June in New York, I was standing just off a curb in Midtown Manhattan, trying unsuccessfully to get a cab to LaGuardia Airport. I found myself having thoughts about the city which would not have pleased the Convention and Visitors Bureau, thoughts about the weather, thoughts about the structural flaws of the New York taxi industry. Then, still with no free taxis in sight, a Lincoln town car appeared in front of me. The uniformed driver lowered the window, and I was hit with frigid air. "Where are you going?" he said. "LaGuardia," I said. $25. Deal. I got in. The driver identified himself as Jose. As we made it over the bridge and hit the Grand Central Parkway, he told me that he was from Ecuador, a country I had visited a few months before. I told him how much I'd enjoyed Ecuador, the gorgeous mountains, the markets, the climate that some have described as eternal spring, and most of all, the ceviche. Ceviche in Ecuador, I said, is to American ceviche what the seafood cocktails of Veracruz, oysters, shrimp, snails, octopus, crab, avocado, onions, and coriander, chopped in front of your eyes into a liquid that in a just world would be what Bloody Mary mix tastes like, are to those balsa wood and ketchup combinations that people in country club dining rooms get when they order the shrimp cocktail appetizer. Ecuadorian ceviche starts out with fresh fish, cured by being marinated in lemon juice and enlivened by whatever else the chef has thought to add. It's liquid like a bowl of tangy cold soup. Roasted corn kernels, flicked off Andean corn, whose kernels are sometimes the size of broad beans, are served on the side to be tossed in for both flavor and crunch. Some restaurants offer as accompaniment not only roasted corn kernels, but popcorn. Yes, popcorn, what less fortunate humans eat at the movies. "You like that ceviche?" Jose asked. He sounded pleased, but mildly surprised, like an artist who has just heard effusive praise of a painting that is actually one of his earlier works. "I love that ceviche, Jose," I said. "I would probably kill for that ceviche." "When's your plane?" Jose asked. "Oh, I've got time," I said. I had left myself a buffer for finding a taxi and grumbling about the city. Instantly, he swerved off the Grand Central, and we were driving along a commercial street in Queens. Most of the signs on the stores were in Spanish. Some were in Chinese or Korean. In 5 minutes, we turned onto a side street in front of a restaurant called Islas Galapagos. We asked for two orders of ceviche. I ordered a cold Ecuadorian beer. We cleaned our bowls. Then we got back into the car and drove to LaGuardia. "This is a great city, Jose," I said as I hauled my baggage out of the icy splendor of his town car. "A little hot sometimes, but a great city."
Writer Calvin Trillin's latest book is Feeding a Yen. Concert pianist turned food writer Anya von Brimson writes for Travel and Leisure magazine. Her beat is the world, but her latest trip was to her homeland, to Russia, to check out the restaurant scene. Anya, welcome back.
Great to be here.
So was it sort of a homecoming for you?
It was and it wasn't, because I haven't been back for 10 years, and I really returned to a different country. And I must say, a much more exciting and better country, in terms at least how people live, and certainly the food.
What is the food scene like? I mean, are there great restaurants? Are people eating out even?
Well, a certain class of people, certainly. And there's a huge difference between Moscow and St. Petersburg. You know, literally they're 20 years apart. And Moscow is booming. It really reminds me of Shanghai 2-3 years ago, Berlin 3 years ago. It's the same kind of manic post-communist energy. And some people have a lot of money, a lot of cash. They're eager to spend it, and restaurants are the way to go. So in Moscow, you really encountered places just that you would in London in terms of decor, food. I mean, super sleek. Ducasse might be coming there. Nobu Matsuhisa might be coming there, or at least there are rumors. You know, when I was there, Nobu Matsuhisa was there, and it was completely sold out. So people are really savvy, and they're spending money like crazy. It's just unbelievable.
You know, I'm thinking, ever since I heard that you can get a latte in Nepal, I figured that local food is probably being replaced by kind of global eating. Is this what's happening now in Moscow?
There's so much on so many different levels. You know, certainly you can get a latte in any shade of flavor you want to. And sushi is replacing selyotka, which is herring, as a sort of a national food. At the same time, especially I found it true in St. Petersburg, there's a lot of restaurants that are kind of pedal nostalgia, you know, because they really feel like the food culture has been obliterated for 70 years, and they're trying to catch up. So they're picking up where they left off in 1917, and there's a fashion for kind of this 19th century foods. A lot of the menus and restaurants have old-fashioned spelling, you know, before the orthographic reform. All the strange foods that, you know, Soviets have never heard of that are, you know, being culled from 19th century cookbooks. So it's going inwards, looking back at its past, and it's globalizing like crazy.
Are there any particular places that you think exemplify this looking back into the past, or this very new looking forward?
Well, there's a place in Moscow called Cafe Pushkin, and it's a brand new building, but it looks like a 19th century manor. You know, all these cracks in the ceilings and all this kind of pattern of age, and it's all faux. It's all brand new. And they have precisely that kind of 19th century menu, looking swooningly and lovingly and dotingly at the 19th century.
What do you mean when you're talking 19th century food? I mean, what kind of dishes are you talking about?
Well, it's a grand tradition, first of all, of pies, you know, because baking savory pies was huge in the 19th century. Very lavish spreads of appetizers called zakuski, that sort of stuff. And also quite Frenchified, because Russian cuisine was very much influenced by France. Then in St. Petersburg, there's a place called Podvorye, and they're doing something slightly different. They're kind of singing odes to the country cuisine of, you know, Chekhov and Gogol and Tolstoy. So everything is self-sufficient. They grow their own vegetables. They make their own juices. And it's run by this very interesting figure, a new type of tycoon, a new kind of millionaire with a conscience. And, you know, instead of sort of profiteering and stealing, you know, he opened this place, which is wildly successful. And he contributes a lot to charity, but, you know, he has this kind of idea of a self-sufficient Russophilic, you know, Slavophilic paradise, which is really exciting.
This sounds like shades of Dr. Zhivago before the war.
Something like that, yes. I mean, that idea has come back.
We hear so much about shortages in Russia. Are these places solely for the wealthy? I mean, how are other people eating?
I think shortages are gone. Shortages was something that was induced by communists, and now with free economy, basically everything is available. You go to a supermarket and there are, you know, 60 kinds of salamis. I mean, I couldn't believe it myself, and people are just very blasé about it. And what I was happy to find, especially in Moscow, that lower middle class is able to afford, certainly not these kind of places, you know, where you can spend $100 a person easily. But there are places, for instance, there's all these lovely all-you-can-eat concepts. Like there's one called Yolki Palki, where for $10 you have like unlimited buffet of very, very nice lovely Russian foods, and certainly young people make enough money to afford a $10 lunch.
Well, Anya, thank you.
Pleasure.
Anya von Bremsen writes about food and travel for Travel and Leisure magazine. She's working on a book on the world's 100 great dishes. Now, she left us with a recipe for classic Russian blinis. I think you know the drill by this time. You go to the website. It's splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. This week's question is, what heavenly body dictates success in both the vegetable garden and the wine cellar? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what heavenly body dictates success in the vegetable garden and the wine cellar? Well, it's not the sun. It's the moon. Winemaking and agriculture were, and for many still are, governed by the phases of the moon. Now, here's how it always worked for my family. All leafy foods are planted when the moon is rising. This encourages leaf growth. So think herbs, salads, and greens. When you want the fruit of a plant, like tomatoes or beans or eggplants, you plant when the moon is waning. That way the plant's energy goes into the fruit, not the leaves. I mean, what we're talking about here is basic gravity. Wine was all about gravity, too, especially the bottling of wine. You always bottle a fizzy wine when the moon is rising. It will sustain the bubbles. Now, if you are bottling a sweet wine that has a lot of sugar, now, if it has a lot of sugar, that means it's going to continue fermenting in the bottle. Well, you always bottle this kind of sweet wine when the moon is going down, because this keeps the fermentation under control. If you were to bottle that wine when the moon's going up, it would all go out of control and the wine would spoil. This is why farmers' calendars always show the phases of the moon. The sun may nourish, but the moon is the controller. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Tom on the line. So, Tom, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I'd like to talk about a little thing called stevia.
Ah, the sweetener?
Well, I've been doing some research on the web, and I realize it's illegal to call it a sweetener.
Is it really?
The FDA got harangued by the sugar industry a couple years back to the point that they were stopping cargoes of the stuff from coming in. And you can call it a dietary supplement, but not a sweetener.
Okay, so you want to talk about the dietary supplement called stevia. Or
that
stevia.
One, yeah, just so that no one gets in any trouble. I love public broadcasting. Don't want anything go wrong.
Okay, but what do you want to talk about,
well,
specifically?
I got... 2 years back, I got a plant from a local Portland herb shop,
uh-huh.
And the leaves are really fantastic for crushing into teas and to coffee.
Yeah, yeah.
Recently, I noticed in Trader Joe's, they're selling big canisters of the stuff,
uh-huh.
And I've been using it to sweeten coffee and tea, and I just want to know, what else can I do with it?
Well, what I remember, I use it sporadically. It's so intensely sweet. You have to remember, it's like 150 to 200 times sweeter than sugar. So I find if you use a very tiny amount of it, and one of the ways that I've used it is, for instance, I'm making a custard or I'm making one of those desserts that have gelatin in it, and I'm going to chill it. Because I can taste my way through the amount,
uh-huh.
You know, as opposed to a cake. I have no idea what would happen to it if you baked with it. But
I found out, actually, that because it doesn't have the same chemical makeup as sugar,
yeah.
You can't substitute it just for sugar.
Exactly, exactly.
Things will fall down and not crystallize. And...
Right, it that makes a lot of sense. But what I've done is I've added it to... for instance, I make panna cotta, which is you warm cream, you melt gelatin in it, you add some sour cream, and instead of sugar, I would keep adding to taste, little bit by little bit, the stevia.
Yeah.
One other thing, too, is I've used it with bittersweet chocolate.
Ooh.
So when I want to make a fudge sauce, I've used a very tiny amount of that with bittersweet chocolate and then, you know, the cream and the butter and the corn syrup. But I cut back a bit on the corn syrup and I'll use that. But you know what I've read, which is kind of interesting, is that, do you know it's been used in Japan for a long time in all kinds of commercial food?
I'm just beginning to realize this, that they're using it everywhere else but here.
Yeah, well, it seems so. But, you know, the mysteries of our FDA, not to be known by we folk. But, Tom, thanks for a great question.
Well, thank you.
Hey, you take care.
I will. Thanks.
Bye. This is one of those sweeteners. It's interesting to play with, but oh, please start out with a pinch. 800-537-5252. Give us a call. We have Nitta on the phone. Nitta, what do you want to talk about? What's up?
Hi. Actually, I'm calling about a sweetener, too. Beets. A friend of mine, we went to a restaurant. We had chocolate cake, and it was the most awesome chocolate cake. And they told us the sweetener was beets.
Really?
So we set out to try and make beet cake. We found some recipes with really disastrous results. We're wondering, is it, you know, do you use raw beets, cooked beets? Do you have any idea how to use beets in a cake?
You know, I haven't done a lot of testing with this, but I've always been fascinated by this idea of things like this in cakes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they came out of World War One, out of both World Wars, where there was a lot of rationing. Because you have sauerkraut cake, there's, you know, tomato soup cake, there's Coca-Cola cake, and I think a lot of it was about rationing of fats and rationing of sugar.
Sugar and trying to find sugar alternatives.
Now, the one recipe I've seen that I can remember seeing is the Stearns, Jane and Michael Stern.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, they did a book, I think it's Blue Ribbon Recipes from Blue Ribbon Chefs.
Okay.
And it's about the road food that they find. And there's a recipe in there for a chocolate beet cake, but I have never tested it.
Okay. Well, she bought a lot of beets, grated them, and froze them after the, you know, her
right.
recipe failed. So we have beets.
Well, this is what I would do. I would never use them raw because I have a sneaking suspicion they're going to throw off a lot of liquid,
yeah.
therefore throw off the recipe. I would bake them, just scrub them, cut off the top and bottom, leave the skin on, wrap them in foil, bake them until you can easily pierce them with a knife.
Okay.
400 degrees an hour. And then when they cool, you can just slough off the skin. And now they're going to be intensely sweet, and they're going to not have a heck of a lot of moisture in them.
Mm.
What has been the main problem with the recipes you've been using?
Well, the recipe she tried, I think the beets actually outweighed the flour. Her cake slid around on the plate and left a red stain. It just was really bad. Mine was actually cooked beets, cooked and then grated, but it was boiled.
Yeah.
And, you know, the cake, the texture was really nice, but it had that beet taste.
Yeah, I think you have to be careful. Again, I'm just foggy on this, but I think the way Jane and Michael's recipe worked, there were a couple of cups of flour, a half a cup of the beets.
Very small amount of beets.
Yeah, but it made it very moist, which was one of the goals. There was fat in it. There was a cup of oil. I think there was even a cup of sugar and cocoa and then some kind of leavening and vanilla, you know, that kind of thing. But the point is, I think the beets cannot be in a super large quantity because then all you'll be eating is beets and chocolate.
Right.
So I'd take a look. It's Blue Ribbon Recipes from Blue Ribbon Chefs by the Stearns. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if that recipe was not on their website.
Oh, they have a website.
They have a website. And I think it's something like roadfood.com or janeandmichaelstern.com. So take a look.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. I see now that all of our listeners are going to start cooking up with beets and sauerkraut, which is not a bad thought. Okay, 800-537-5252. Doug, you are up next. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I would like to talk about the amazing thing that happened to me. My little boy and I planted a garden, and we actually got celery, and a lot of it. And it turns out that the flavor is astonishingly good. And I wondered if what I could do with it to present it more other than something as a crunchy background.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One thing is to take the celery, cut it in lengths that are a couple of inches long, and brown it in a little bit of butter with some leeks, cut up leeks, and then add broth and simmer it for about 10 minutes until it's tender. Boil off all the liquid so it's like a syrup, and you serve the braised celery warm, or you serve it at room temperature.
and it's fabulous. And you get sort of a celery essence. And it's just salt and pepper and celery and a little bit of the leeks.
So that sounds great.
And then, you know, I'm a firm believer. I love cream cheese and sour cream with things like celery. And you know about stuffed celery, but if you want to point up all the flavors of the celery, mix a little cream cheese and sour cream with a lot of salted pistachios and a little bit of red onion. And put just a small amount in stalks of celery. Cut it up into bite-sized pieces and crunch on it.
Okay. The other question I had is with the leaves.
Oh, yeah.
Delicious flavor in them.
You know what's great? And it, you have to stand back. Don't have your son anywhere near the stove when you do this. Take a skillet, put about a half inch of oil in it, get it quite hot. Make sure the leaves are bone dry. Mm-hmm. Drop them in, and they're going to foam up. And in a second, pull them out and just lightly salt them. And it will put popcorn and potato chips out of business.
Well, that sounds great.
It is
I would love to do that in my house.
The other thing is those leaves are great in soup. They can overpower. But what I would do is I'd freeze them and then use them in soups and stews. They're going to be mushy, but you'll get the great flavor.
Great.
Use a little bit at a time.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Hey, you take care.
You too.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Call us at 800-537-5252. We've got Rose calling. Rose, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Love your show. And
thank
I have
you.
A question. I recently had a dinner party with women who are either professional chefs or had been. And I asked everyone to bring a dish, something they'd never made before.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat at a table, long table, 12 of us, and presented our courses one at a time, small plates of each of the dishes. And I was wondering if we were eating them tapas style, if in a tapas style meal or menu you would all be eating the same small plate of something, or if it was more of a buffet type of thing, if tapas were served where all the different dishes were out on the table at one time and everyone partakes along those lines. So we couldn't answer that question, and I wondered if you could answer it for us.
Well, I'm going to give it a shot.
Okay.
My understanding is that tapas originated in Spain being essentially bar food that you, in the early evening, because you eat very late in Spain, you would go out and have a sherry,
mm-hmm.
you know, or a glass of wine. And on the bar would be these little plates of all these different tastes. You know, it might be sliced sausage with a sauce of garlic and almonds. There might be just almonds and, you know, from elaborate, from cooked warm
mm-hmm.
things to things that, are cold.
Mm-hmm.
And they're constantly being refreshed. So you take a little plate and eat what you wish. But I just went to a restaurant that specialized in tapas. And what we were told was you order about three or four plates. Let's say you're four people at the table. You would order no more than four plates at a time.
Okay.
And you go from light to more robust,
mm-hmm.
right? And you can also go from cold to warm, but it's really the light to more robust. So you were eating quasi-tapas style. No, I mean, originally this was a case where you'd be standing at a bar or you'd be sitting down at a bar and you would go up and take what would entertain you and you might usually try maybe one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's become so fashionable now to be a meal unto itself.
Yes, and it was a wonderful evening, but we couldn't figure out that tapas question. So.
Are you a professional cook?
I used to do catering,
uh-huh.
And I teach cooking at a Montessori school. I teach elementary children during the lunch hour how to prepare a meal, and we cook together once or twice a week, and it's really been fun.
It sounds great.
Yeah.
Hey, you can get them making tapas.
I will.
Simple things.
Thank you. Thank you.
You take care. Bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Call us at 800-537-5252. I was in the market recently, and I was looking at peas. And you know how you talk to people that are in the produce aisle? And there was one batch of peas called English peas, and there was another batch of peas called sugar snap peas. And this person was saying to me, what's the difference? And I thought, you know, that's a really good question. So let me tell you the difference. English peas is the fancy name for the good old-fashioned garden pea. And this is a pea that the pod is not edible. Okay, it's kind of stringy. And usually these peas, as soon as they're picked, their sugar gradually starts to turn to starch. So you want to get them as fresh as possible and cook them right away. This isn't something you tuck away in the fridge for a week. The other kind of pea is the sugar snap, and there's a lot of different types of sugar snaps. And this is a pea that's essentially a cross between that garden pea and the snow pea pod that you use in Chinese cooking. And the pod is edible, and they've done something to this pea that keeps it sweet. You can stick this in the refrigerator for a week, and it's still going to taste pretty darn sweet. And you eat the entire pea. So that's the difference. English peas, you don't eat the pod. They get lose their sweetness a little more quickly. Sugar snaps hang on to the sweetness, and you can't eat the pod. With all that, call us. 800-537-5252. We've got Keith calling. So, Keith, what's up?
Well, I'm a big gardener, and I have right many lavender plants, and I live in North Carolina, so I plant English lavender, and I wanted to find out if you knew of any recipes that utilize lavender.
All right, I'll make a deal with you. I'll trade. Okay. I'll give you some recipes if you'll send me a huge bundle of lavender. I love lavender.
You got a deal.
I love lavender. Okay, you want to cook with it.
Yep.
There's a lot of stuff you can do with lavender, but I've got a favorite because it always surprises people.
Okay.
Grown-up Jell-O.
Okay.
You do this for summer, and you can serve it on its own, or you can put it over ice cream, or you can put it over fruit. You take white wine, okay, like a dry white wine, and you actually put it in a saucepan, and you add sugar to taste.
Okay.
So you add enough sugar until you get it just about the sweetness that you want. And then you throw in about, well, let's say you've got 2 cups of white wine. You want about 2 tablespoons of lavender flowers.
Okay.
Right. And you simmer that until it's clear, until the sugar has melted.
How thick should it be?
It's not going to be very thick. I mean, it's going to be like milk.
Okay.
Essentially. Okay. And then what you do is you stir in a little bit of gelatin that you've soaked in cold water. You can leave the lavender flowers in or you can strain them out. But when that's completely melted, you set it aside covered for about 20 or 30 minutes and then strain it or not strain it. But you can put it into ice cube trays or you can just put it into a shallow pan, chill it, and then cut it into small cubes. And then you can put those cubes in a pretty wine glass, sprinkle them with a little bit more lavender and top them with whipped cream. It's called Jell-O, but it's grown-up Jell-O.
Idea.
Yeah. And as I said, dynamite over fruit. Peaches great with this, died and gone to heaven.
Well,
so give it a shot.
Thank you so much. That's a great idea.
You are welcome. And enjoy the lavender.
Hey, I'll send you some.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care, Keith. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this bit of wisdom from rural Italy. One must be careful of two things, young wives and fresh baked bread. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. You can find everything you heard here and so much more on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, don't miss out on our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and we hope that it helps to make your weeknight cooking a little easier. You can register for it online at splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.